Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Old Heads. Myself and my usual friend, Mike Fenwick, and we've got a special guest tonight, who is Kenny McCaskill, former Justice Minister and now MP for East Lothian. Good evening, Kenny.
Good evening. Thanks for the invite.
Welcome, Kenny.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
What I wanted to do, Dave, if I may, is kick off with something that is identified with Kenny, which was a piece he did in Wings Over Scotland to do with a request that the grassroots start marching again. Now, we are faced with COVID, and Kenny appreciated that when he was writing the article. What I wanted to do was introduce him and anyone else that's listening to what you and I, Dave, are very much involved in at the moment, which we're calling the Long Walk to Freedom, which is COVID-friendly, is designed that way so that we're not walking en masse. There'll be dedicated walkers. You know far more about the details of how it's being organised, Dave, than I do. So can I pass over to you to try and explain what's to happen and how it's designed?
Well, basically, 2 years ago, we did the 500 miles. We started in Skye and finished in Edinburgh on the day the 100,000 march in Edinburgh, all under one banner. We're looking to start three different walks on the sixth anniversary of the referendum in 2014. So that'll be the 18th of September from Éireann Donnan Castle in the north. One of the walks is going to be going south to Glasgow, which is going to end up 500 miles. There's another one which is going to be 1,320 miles, which is going up around the north coast and then around the east coast. And a third one that's 700 that's going to cover the border starting to air from the day that the main march, which is Aberdeen. So Kenny was saying that we should start marching again. We've got people and they're going to be marching. And we're hoping to finish on St Andrew's Day at Berwick at the border. And the good thing about this is that we're completely COVID-friendly and we're going to... It's a people's thing, the same as the 500 was. So it's something along those lines.
What I wanted to draw you into, Kenny, for your observation in this, I tend to read a lot, and your article in particular that you wrote for Wings was something that caught my eye, because you started off by saying that symbolism matters in politics, and what can be a relatively small action can have long-term consequences and big consequences. Mm-hmm. And you used two examples of that. That's what I would like to draw you on, because the one was the Million Man March in Washington that you mentioned, and the other one was the hands across the Baltic as it related to Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. This march will be more than symbolic, because ostensibly what we're trying to do is get people involved in signing the Scottish Digital Covenant as something very, very important. We are, and don't take this the wrong way, without political intervention directly, grassroots can participate in signing something which may help achieve Scotland's independence. Can I pass that, both the symbolism of the walk and then the practicality of what we're going to try and achieve, over to you, please, Kenny?
Well, I think that's here to be welcomed. I mean, I think these things are, the more the merrier. They come large, they come small. You know, the Million Man March, you know, I vaguely remember, you know, and have seen 60s, civil rights stuff from America, spoken to friends who actually were there. We've got to remember that that was the big climatic march, but there was lots of smaller ones from Selma, Meredith, and an individual things. So things started the same as more latterly, and, you know, and more attuned to nationalism, the hands across the Baltic as the Baltic states look to get their independence from the Soviet Union. So I think, you know, symbolism matters, and, you know, we've got to realise that politics is changing. We're not going to be out chapping doors and leafleting, certainly not probably before Christmas because of coronavirus. Even after that, there'll be a lot of nervousness, not just amongst activists who might be a wee bit perturbed, a lot of the recipients of a knock at the door and a canvasser, or might have even just had a leaflet, might not be too happy. So we've got to think, how do we address that? It can't all be dealt with digitally as you and I are doing with, because we know that a lot of our poorest areas have a digital divide. They don't have the access to the computer that I'm sitting here with and the laptop that I have provided by the Parliament That's why, you know, the symbolism isn't just the big marches. It's got to be wee marches in our housing streets, those communities that turned out 75, 80, 90%, and where if we can put the turn up 5 or 10%, we don't need to convert no to yes. We just need to get those who didn't vote out to vote yes. So we've got to do that. That's why I think those who jumped upon the piece, who tried to be suggesting and implying that what I was going to do was going to threaten the whole country with COVID-19 reviving. Nobody was suggesting that we were going to do a million man march a week on Saturday or anything like that. It was about preparing at some stage for a big demonstration when, you know, that is possible. But equally, static marches have already begun. We've seen that in demonstrations on the NHS. We'll be seeing it on demonstrations by the UK government on VJ Day. So I think the demonstrations that you're talking about that are socially distanced, that follow the guidance, that actually get the message out there are absolutely necessary. I think, like many activists, I'm frustrated with the suggestion that we cannot do anything until we've defeated coronavirus. That is just not true. While we are being told to down tools and stay at home and do nothing, they've taken us out of the EU. They are transforming our society for the worse. And I even look across the sea at Ireland. Not only have they reacted better to dealing with COVID-19 in many ways than certainly even Scotland or England have dealt with, they've managed to, you know, form a government, change the Taoiseach, you know, pull everybody together. You know, life can go on. So this suggestion that politics has to be on hold other than internal SNP machinations, no. So long as we follow the guidance, follow the rules, we have got to get back out. A big march is a long way away, but taking steps and actually letting our communities, because the big danger is that these communities that voted overwhelmingly for us in 2014 will think we've forgotten them and will probably say, well, nobody votes for, I voted for Labour and I voted for the SNP, nothing changed. We've got to show that we still care. We've got to give hope and belief that things can change. That's why marches, static or otherwise, as long as they're providing for social distance and following the guidance, are necessary.
Couldn't agree with you more, Kenny. Dave will confirm this. You remember back to 2014, the phrase that came up was Project Fear. Then people have developed that into Hope Over Fear. And Dave will confirm for you, I've now adopted the phrase Action Over Hope. Because I think the walks that's going to take place are going to take us close to every town, every city, and every village in Scotland. Mm-hmm. If you're within probably 15, 20 miles, the walk will be there. And what we'll be doing is answering questions on the covenant. And there's a second point to this that I want to try and raise. You often hear people talk about the fact that we'll need international recognition. I'm one of the volunteers on Independence Live when the marches were on or the rallies were on. And with someone else called Fiona McKinnon, we set something up. We did it at the big Edinburgh rally. We also did it in Glasgow, which was to invite the world to attend those rallies and those marches. And what we did was ask people to recognise that the Scottish diaspora around the world is bigger than the total population of Scotland. And one of the things with the covenant, and I don't think people fully realise this, is if you're resident in Scotland and registered to vote in Scotland, you supply the ID to confirm that. But if you're out with, and I had a conversation with someone that's based in England today, and they said, look, I had to move for a job from Scotland, but I want to join in. How can I do that? And I said, well, as part of this, you can support. Mm-hmm. If you can't sign it, you can support the idea of the covenant. And one of the things I'm going to try and do, and I'm hoping people that Mr. McCaskill MP might involve himself in this, is to start getting in touch with other politicians. The EU know that we are being taken out of the EU. Now, leave that aside as a subject for after independence, but right now, they know that 62% of the Scots said, we don't want to leave. Can you and your fellow MPs and MSPs get in touch with the EU and say, look, there's a covenant going on. It's going to be signed by the population of Scotland. We need a certain number, but we also need to see support from that. And this is where your piece struck me when it talked about Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. They understand what it is to try and obtain their freedom from the Soviet bloc. I think there's support for that out there, Kenny, and I'm hoping that that's part of what we can do, is get the international community to also support what individual people, grassroots people, are doing in Scotland.
I think that it's important to raise the profile, and certainly you're right. I mean, I do remember the Hands Across the Baltic. I mean, I remember the sort of footage that was significant, and I've got a good friend lives in Estonia. I've visited all the Baltic states, and I go to Estonia quite regularly, and Ian Lawson, who you'll know, is the Consul General for the country, and he knows it very well. I think the only caveat I ever have is that international politics is all about national self-interest. I can think of international politicians I have met who will wish Scotland well, who will say privately, I hope you do it. Will they do anything publicly? At the end of the day, it's their national interest, and they'll say, we wish you well privately, we'll not do anything for you. The most you can get is to put them into neutral. And to some extent, that was what happened with the Soviet Union. Nobody rushed to the aid of the Baltic states. They didn't do it when the Soviets invaded in 1941, and they certainly didn't as the Soviet Union was collapsing. They were privately wishing them well. So I think what we need to do in Scotland is to make sure that people are aware of us, to gather as much support if we can, which tend to come from individuals rather than nations, because nations will say that they can't do that. But equally, what you can make sure is that people allow an even playing field, so that people do speak out against the actions of the country that you're seeking liberation from, whether that's the Soviet Union, whether it's Spain with Catalonia, and people say that that's unacceptable. So I think what we do is raise the profile of Scotland. And certainly it seems to me that in numerous, it's not just what we've done, because there's always been a warmth towards Scotland, but the behaviour of Britain has well and truly alienated a lot of people. So there's good wishes. I wouldn't hold my breath that is going to result in anything, either tangible, but you're certainly going to get the good wishes. And if that allows you a level playing field with no obstacles, that's the most you can hope for.
One of the things I'm thinking of in terms of this is that we know that the Westminster establishment are watching what's happening in Scotland. The objective is to try and get the 54% who are saying that they're in favour of independence to sign the covenant. I think as the number of people, let's say you get to 50,000, then 100,000, then 500,000, Westminster will be watching that. One of my fears, Kenny, is that eventually Boris might just say, right, you can have your Section 30, but here are the conditions. One is a threshold. The second is, if you lose, you're going to have to wait a generation, and this time it's got to be legal. And again, I read recently that the Fabian Society, part of Labour's think tank, if you like, we're proposing exactly that type of manoeuvring where there would be thresholds involved. Mm. What do you hear of that down in Westminster, if you're down there?
Well, I've only been down once, basically, since the kind of lockdown, so I've not really picked up anything. I saw the Fabian article. I mean, it's an organisation that is supposed to be, the intellectual wing of the Labour Party, but frankly, they've moved far to the right, as far as I can see. The Fabians used to be radical at the time of Shaw and others when they were... when they first came about, but they've shamefully abandoned that. But just to address, I actually think you'll find that there's a great deal of support for the covenant. I mean, it resonates in Scotland from John McCormick, from Sheriff Thompson. And I also remember, when we fought the poll tax and we asked for, well, I think Jim Sullers made the claim that we get 100,000, non-payers of the poll tax. And then after the first few weeks, it was like, Lordy, how are we ever going to get that? And as it was, we got well beyond 100,000. So I think, actually getting people to sign up to the covenant, I think that's perfectly possible. And again, it's symbolism. It's an activity that again, can be countenanced for social distancing and how people do it, informally or otherwise. Equally, in terms of the Fabian thing, that is trying to just tie us down. There is an argument that constitutional change, should have thresholds or whatever, but it's never been applied for anything else. Because I had a constituent that wrote in about that, And I did say to him, I can understand that in some countries that is what happens, that a constitutional change requires. But that has not been the format in Scotland. It's not been the format in the UK. Whatever, you know, decision it has been on the EU, on the EEC, on the voting thing that the Lib Dems brought in, the alternative vote, nobody ever imposed anything. The only thing we've ever had was the 40% threshold imposed deliberately against Scotland. So I think, you know, this idea of the Fabians had, I mean, it looked to me, first of all, the thresholds that they were putting, you were never going to get any change on anything because it was so high. And I say, I could understand if there was a logical argument that said it would apply, you know, in terms of an independent Scottish constitution, there are some things that you might want to look at that. But in terms of where we are at the moment, it would be utterly unacceptable to impose a threshold upon us that hadn't been imposed upon other critical factors, in particular, taking us out of the EU. And, you know, the 40% threshold will never be countenanced by us again, given that we won the last referendum in 79, and they seem to write that out of history.
Okay, well, one thing I'll go back to on your international recognition. President Macron actually came out for Scottish independence earlier on in the week in an interview with the translation. It was in a French interview, and basically he was asked about Scottish independence, and he said... Well, the Scots are definitely, they're the love and understand Europe. And then the interviewer said, so you support Scottish independence? And he said twice, he says, I support a European Scotland.
as close as you could get.
Yeah.
Not quite De Gaulle, I'm Vive le Quebec,
there we go. Maybe just as well.
That's where we get into the phrase, Kenny, of not talking the talk, but walking the walk. Mm. And that's partly behind what we're doing.
Another thing that you see there, Kenny, was just about symbolism. The one in the '50s, there was no sort of backup for it. It was done. It was signed by 2 million people. But here there's a possibility that if we can prove that an absolute majority of the Scottish voters have signed it, it doesn't have to take a politician or a first minister or a parliament that's been born under the auspices of the Scotland Act to present it to the United Nations. If you use the international, Craig Murray's written quite a lot about it. It's not a point of domestic law. And if you had a provable majority of people, and guaranteed by a blockchain as well, to prove that they were legitimate voters, that it could be taken further. And, I'd be quite happy for a politician to present it. But there wouldn't have to be. It would just have to be a representative chosen by the people, and then let the politicians clear up the mess afterwards.
Well, again, I think anything like that is symbolic. I wouldn't be, again, you know, holding my breath for the UN doing anything. Otherwise, you know, the people of Palestine might actually have achieved something. All these resolutions have been passed and nothing's been done. And now we find the country being, you know, cut into apartheid Bantu stands, shamefully. But it's important that you do these things.
Looking forward to the end of this year, and we're going to end up with a probable no-deal Brexit on top of what's happening with the virus at the moment. How bad's that going to be, Kenny? And what can we do to deal with it?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think there will be a deal. I think, you know, they're positioning. But Johnson is, you know, my old mum would have said, would have sold his granny for glue. And they will. I mean, I think there'll be a deal, you know, between the UK and the EU. It might not necessarily be the, you know, Brexit in name only, but probably won't be a kick in the grass off it, because they're realising just how catastrophic this is. There are no international trade deals opening up. You know, the US is now looking as if, you know, it's too early to say that Trump's definitely going to lose, but it looks as if it's going to be Biden. So they're negotiating something that could have to be rewritten. So everything's gone. I think they'll sign a deal of sorts. You know, this will be resolved. But the unemployment crisis is coming and coming fast, because as the GRS system downplays, people are being laid off, and it's going to be a lot worse than the unemployment that we had before, because unemployment in the 80s was in key areas and communities that were devastated. This is going to be across the board. You know, it's not just when I used to drive from to work in Glasgow in 82 when you saw the Blackburns and the Bathgates and the Motherwells were all getting tanned, but other areas were left. People who are, you know, in in nice houses are being laid off. There's going to be middle class unemployment that didn't happen in the 1980s, other than for a few, you know, senior managers and, you know, British Leyland or whatever. It hit the industrial working class. Now we're getting it across the board. So the situation is going to be grim for a while. But then, you know, it's what you do about it. And that's why I don't have any faith in the UK and why we've got to get out of it. You know, I look, you know, Ireland, that will come out of it, that what they'll come out of the coronavirus crisis is with a health service, because they've not had a properly functioning NHS, the same as we are. They've actually had to take over a lot of the private hospitals that were run by churches and charities and institutions. I heard the President Higgins speaking. They will come out and will, as a result of this, be an Irish health service. We're just getting ever greater inequality. And that's going to continue. The ruling oligarchy of the millionaires or billionaires are getting richer and we're getting left. So that's why, you know, normal received wisdom would be, this is not the time for major constitutional change. I think, you know, you just got to reverse it and say, this is the time for major constitutional change, because it comes back to the key. You know, it's not just enough to have people vote because they believe in, they're Scottish, they believe in independent Scotland. There's got to be a financial incentive. I think we've now reversed things. People realise that if we don't get out, then the catastrophe is coming is going to be even worse. You know, the problem we faced in 2014 was the risk. They wanted to vote for independence, but they thought they couldn't risk it. What will happen to this? What will happen to that? The security that was Britain. We would be in the EU. We would be in NATO. Everything would be hunky-dory. Our currency, our pensions, our pound. Now the pound has crashed, the economy is actually, the risk is in staying. There's a risk in going and becoming an independent Scotland, but that's being offset by the risk in staying, where you've got people who care nothing about anything other than the self-aggrandizement of their narrow kleptocracy that's taken over the Tory party and the British ruling class.
I think that's recognised by a hell of a lot of people in Scotland who previously maybe weren't convinced about the risk involved, Kenny. Way back in 1985, the Thatcher period, when unemployment was about 3 million, I had a meeting with a guy called Michael Allison, MP, and that was Margaret Thatcher's private secretary. He introduced me to the Manpower Services Commission, because I had an idea at that time about how you could cope with unemployment. And you remember, if you go back to that time, we all had paper files. We didn't have an internet. Mm-hmm. We didn't have functioning computers. And what we had done using what was called the YTS scheme, the youth training scheme, We employed a lot of young people in the company I ran at that time. And we got them to take the paper files and put them onto computers. Whereas previously, the males who dominated offices would go up to a secretary or a typist and say, take this dictation. That, those days have gone. But if you go back to then, we all had paper files. They don't exist any longer. And what happened, and why I got in touch with Michael Allison, MP, was to say, look, I think this can be taken further. All the young people can be trained up in computer skills, because that's the coming world. He then put me in touch with the Manpower Services Commission and the head of it, and we had a meeting. Mm-hmm. We created jobs that way around. Mm-hmm. You had contacts. I had contacts mm-hmm. with the state agents and solicitors. We introduced mm-hmm. people who had done the YTS scheme in our company and mm-hmm. moved them on to other companies. It's all in Paisley. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the skill that we need now is to do something similar to that. But I'm sure there's a green revolution coming. That's part of it. There are jobs that can be created if we're creative about it. And this is where I then go back to agreeing with you 100%. The risk is, if we're not out of the UK, those opportunities will be lost. We've got to create them in Scotland. Like an awful lot of things that need, the risk is not in leaving the UK. The risk is actually in staying in.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be left as a holiday park. That'll be the plan for us. They can come up in their RVs and enjoy the unspoiled rural parts, although too many people are trashing it at the moment. And what we need to do is, you know, use the benefits of, you know, our geography and our climate. You know, there is a, you know, climate change remains the biggest problem facing the human race. Scotland is there at the start of a green revolution. We've got offshore wind, onshore wind, all these technologies. We've got to make sure that we're getting some of the onshore jobs of the offshore revolution that's coming. We might not be able to get a lot of all of the manufacturing of turbines, but we should be able to get a share of some. But there's a whole lot of other jobs that have to be, you know, able to become here. Never mind all the retrofitting that's got to go on in schools, homes, hospitals to make sure that we can deal with climate change. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't matter whether an independent Scotland or still part of the UK, life is going to be miserable for our grandchildren. You know, we've got to be able to do that. I just don't see, you know, Sunak's got credit for basically doing what they rubbished Corbyn, you know, in terms of printing money and actually doing it. There's an irony there. But I just don't think they're going to commit to go beyond that, and the investment will go as ever into, you know, HS2, into, you know, the south of England, because that's where the investment goes. It might go into the northern powerhouse. We ain't going to see it here.
Service companies, it's all going into service companies that are all offshore. Some of the stuff that came out on that Good Law project this week by Julian Mo and I, it was absolutely shocking. No, it wasn't surprising. But it was shocking.
Well, it's a kleptocracy. They're, you know, robbing us blind for their own self-enrichment. You know,
moving on a wee bit, all the stuff that's happening in the NEC recently, well, you any sort of ideas on that? Basically, obviously, Joanna was stopped for being able to stand but at the last minute, and that still seems to be the case, even though the voting system that was used for it seems to have been a wee bit, not the normal one, but they sort of come back on James Dornan and finally let him. Well, you any sort of ideas about that?
Well, I think what happened was a disgrace. I think there's issues in the NEC. When I'm told that the NEC has met twice since lockdown, I think there's something far wrong. I'm told of those two meetings, one was met for 3 hours, couldn't get through item one on the agenda. And then the second one was the one that excluded James Dornan and Joanna Cherry. I mean, you know, the National Executive Committee, I served on a long time back into the 80s and 90s. I was also an office holder as the National Secretary, National Treasurer, rather, and the Vice Convener of Policy. You know, it was a thankless task, but you did it because it was an important role within the party. You used to meet every, you know, I can't remember, it was the first Saturday of the month or whatever. But it was a chore for which you weren't paid, but you were proud to do it, and people served well. I think at the moment there's has to be a democratisation of it. There are organisations sitting around there who are not accountable to anyone other than a handful of people, it would see. It seems to me that you can have people who represent distinct strands within the movement, but they should be elected by a reasonable number of people, not chosen and anointed by a handful of people. And that's where the problem has come, because some of them seem to be representing their own personal interests as opposed to the wider cause of the party or independence. So I think that's got to be addressed, and got to be addressed as fast. It's got to be grassroots democracy. There's always been issues, because as soon as the party went into government, it changed in terms of the government began to set policy more than the party. As soon as after 2014, the mass membership came, there's been issues. I don't think the party's been as sharp as it should have been, or as quick in actually addressing how it deals with that greater democratisation. Never mind the fact that, you know, they've refused to, you know, allow the party activist choice in the likes of Joanna, and all. I think that can be reversed. I think that's something we have to continue to argue for. But also, the party's been clamouring for area organisers, and yet that has never been delivered. It seems to me that actually one of the crying things that's necessary, that as the party's got bigger, a lot of the grassroots activism has actually decreased from what it used to be when we were a party, you know, a fraction of the size. So some of that was always going to be people just signed up to be a member. They didn't want to be an activist, a bit like people used to be in the Labour Club that weren't really interested. There'd be much more beyond that. You know, and we have to accept that. Well, if they vote for us and they give us their money, that's fine. But equally, I think area organisers were important and are important and actually getting the party moving and working again. And, you know, I knew the Alan McKinneys and the Alan McCartneys and all those that actually locally, Alan Todd and others who moved the party in their area when getting SNP votes was very, very hard. Not as easy as it is at the moment.
Funny thing, Kenny, because I wrote a piece recently, without getting into it, about the iron law of oligarchy. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, I think that's what's happened. And I confess I am not a member and never have been of any political party. But here's the point I would make. I'm supposed to live in what's called a representative democracy. Mm-hmm. But when I look at the SNP at the moment, I don't know who's representing me.
Well, I think there is an issue there. The direct election, you know, that you take for granted, because one of the strengths of the SNP and the arguments we always made was that we were a membership-based party where the members called the shots. It wasn't trade unions. There was no bloc votes. And yet we now seem to have anointed groups who don't have any grassroots strength and yet have a disproportionate representation and it can block things on the executive. So I think we've got to make sure that we cover the bases so that organisations representing strands of Scottish society and civic life are represented, you know, especially in equalities, but there's a democratic basis to that so that they can be held accountable and so that they're not just perhaps what some have described as a payroll vote.
You've got the conference coming up, a virtual conference coming up. We had Chris McElhenney on, mm-hmm. while he'd shown he's got his plan B to try and change plan A. We had Jim Fairley on, who wants to look at the Scottish Parliament taking back control of constitutional affairs in Scotland. Mm-hmm. How do you see the conference going with these type of things happening, Kenny?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the big thing has to be a plan B now. I mean, I think, you know, it's becoming quite clear that we can't just go in. And I mean, I've seen this announcement. I mean, I was elected in December 2019. My view, that transformed everything. I think the problem is we've not recognised at senior levels in the party that December 2019 changed everything. You know, it certainly changed everything in terms of what we can do down in Westminster. I've participated in lots of votes, both in the ludicrous system they have of voting down there and virtually from my own room where I'm speaking to you from here today. We lose every one by 80 votes. And we've got to recognise that this idea that somehow or other we're going to get yet another mandate in May of next year, and they're just going to say, oh, all right then. When they've ignored us on Brexit, ignored on trade, ignored us on agriculture, ignored us on immigration, it just ain't going to happen. So this one more huff and we'll puff and we'll blow Boris's house down. No, if he's prepared to set his face towards the English people with Dominic Cummings, why is he going to look at another Scottish mandate and say, oh, that's all right then? So it's just not good enough. Because when in December 2019, I was told there'll be a referendum in the autumn of 2020. Now, I had to say, I said, no, there won't. We're not ready. We don't have the money. We've not laid the groundwork. We've not got the policy. We're not prepared. It ain't happened. Now, we know it's not happening because of coronavirus. But to be frank, it wasn't happening anyway because we weren't ready. We hadn't, you know, sorted out how we were going to deal with the refusal of a Section 30, other than, you know, just saying, oh, well, that's it then, and, you know, all, you know, good efforts to Mr. Keatings, and let's support him, because I think that should be challenged. It's unacceptable. So I think the real issue, at the as well as changing of the guard in terms of how the parties operated centrally, I think has to be a consideration of a plan B. Chris McElhenney and Angus Brendan McNeill have been pilloried by many for calling for it over years. They've been a voice in the wilderness, but it's right, because this idea we'll have a referendum next autumn. We'll have no more of a referendum next autumn than we're going to have this autumn if we don't have a plan B.
And what you're saying about you don't have the money, there is £500,000 for it in 2017 that was supposed to be ring-fenced, that doesn't seem to be there anymore.
Well, we don't know. I mean, I'm more concerned as well that actually we haven't been doing, you know, I can understand why we've had to, you know, work from home, but equally, I would like to see the planning groups are on board about How are we going to address currency? What is our position on rejoining the EU? What do we do in the interim? Because there is a 3 to 5 year gap before you get back into the EU, even if Mr. Macron is fast tracking this or whatever. What is the currency position? Your professor, Tim Ridout, is doing a remarkable job. All these things that individuals have been doing, Chris McElhenney, Tim Ridout, and others, that should be getting done by the party, and it should be getting coordinated, and we should be putting that message out there. You know, we shouldn't just be turning up and saying, you know, so somebody chaps it. You know, if we chap the door now, and I was sent out to canvass for this referendum, and somebody said to me, what's the policy on the border? I don't know. What's the policy on the currency? I don't know. Now, it may be that it's tucked away in SNP HQ. I don't think so, and that is criminal, which is why the work that's been done by individuals has to be dealt with collectively.
It goes back to the something again. I know you've said it was an article in the Scotsman, Kenny, about the Growth Commission. It's out of date. The idea that, I can't understand why the thinking goes this way unless it's to appease a particular section of people that they think are important but are not important. The only people that are important are those that vote. That's where the voice and that's where the change will come from. But there's aspects of pensions that need addressed. Yeah. And you've got the situation with the WASPI women. That didn't happen because the Tories decided it was going to happen. It went back 20, 30 years because if you went back to, say, the 1950s, average age expectation at that time was around age 60 for males and just above for females. Mm-hmm. That's when the planning should have started. Hang on a minute, people are living longer. Mm-hmm. Can we afford this? And that, forgive me, is why I've never been a member of a political party, because politicians need votes. And sometimes if you tell people the hard truth and the cost of the hard truth, mm-hmm. you won't get the votes. That's why I believe in the covenant. It's where you, and I don't mean this disrespectfully in any way. Politics plays a major part in all of this. But if the people don't get their say, if they haven't got the right to say what they want and face the consequences of it, as long as those consequences have been explained to them, that is the way an independent Scotland will prosper. It's when you hide the truth that you end up with WASPI situations. Same with currency. I appreciate what Tim Ridout's doing. The only comment I'll make on currency, Tim Ridout said, okay, we only need a small amount of tests, not those in the Growth Commission. But one of his criteria is a payment system requirement that is away from the banks, away from MasterCard and away from Visa. Dave knows I'm about to sign him up to what is a social enterprise payment system. It's part of my thinking about how you create a yes economy done by the grassroots bottom up. And that is going to be one of the major tasks I'm facing. Frightens me, to be honest with you, but it's something I was involved in back in the 80s. I'm going to have to relearn how I did it back then and try and bring it forward. But that is essential because there seems to be a resistance in HQ. I don't think it's necessarily the SNP HQ. I just think it's within Parliament. There seems to be a resistance to break down barriers. They're reserved powers that they've got, but there's other things that the people can be encouraged to do, and that doesn't seem to be happening.
I think you're right. I mean, we've not been challenging equally. We've got to get some of these things out and test them with people and warm people up. I actually can understand why, you know, there was criticism about the position taken on currency in 2014. I think, you know, the thing was nobody expected that the British would lie, because that's what they did when, you know, Macpherson came up here and Osborne said, oh, there won't be any currency sharing. We found out afterwards from Mark Carney that, yes, there would. They wouldn't actually call it currency sharing, but it would have come about. And I think Alec hadn't anticipated that they would lie, that it would have been, you know, the same as the Irish Free State. It would have been the same as Australia, but they lied. The damage was done. We didn't have a plan B, and we paid the price for it. And they've got away with that lie. Equally, you know, the Growth Commission was 3 years in the making, and then we didn't do anything with it. I could have understood if they'd done even a replication of Blair's, you know, prawn cocktail circuit. They'd gone round the boardrooms in Scotland saying, well, but they did nothing. They put 3 years, put this out that caused a stooshie in the party, understandably so. And of course, with the financial crisis now and the coronavirus, it's gone. And yet there's nothing in the place. So there's a vacuum there. You know, I go back to the time of Jim Mather winning hearts and minds, and if not winning hearts and minds in Scottish boardrooms, neutralising people who might have never voted for us, but wouldn't necessarily have spoken out, and who would have said that they didn't agree with it, but they could understand and they had respect for the credibility of Alex Salmond, Jim Mather, John Swinney, where they were coming from. We've lost all that. It has to be won back. I think Kate Forbes is very able, but we've got to get her out there, actually going around meeting with those people that we know are there. So work has to be done. There are options in currency. You know, a Scottish currency, I think there has to be, because the Growth Commission is now shown to be patently absurd, wouldn't get you through the crisis of coronavirus, and therefore it has to go. A Scottish currency has, you know, has merit equally at some stage, you know, so is joining the euro or whatever. As the pound continues to decline against it, the arguments against it are different, but there's good arguments and there's a debate. And I think you've got to almost soften people up that the pound, that was just one of the strengths of Better Together, you keep the pound. Actually, if you've got your pound, it's collapsing, and if you're, you know, abroad and you're getting your pension in pounds, you're struggling. You know, it's now a currency that's being marked down. And it goes back to that point we were both concurring on earlier, that the risk is in staying, not in going. So it's not just that the Growth Commission is now out of date. There's nothing to replace it. And that's where the work needs to be done, hasn't been done by HQ. And thankfully, people such as Tim Ryder have been doing it. There are others out there, and we've got to actually do it.
You mentioned Alec there. You think he might be the person that's come out and shake everything up a wee bit? Like, as you know, nobody obviously knows what his plans are at the moment. But he's the kind of person who could energise the movement, even if it wasn't within the party, don't you think?
I've always thought that. I mean, I said after he was acquitted, you know, I made it quite clear. I thought the way he should be back for him. If he wishes to rejoin the SNP, he's, you know, the creator of the modern SNP. I had more than my fair share of up and downers with him. But, you know, there's a mutual respect and friendship there. And I think he's got a lot to offer, an awful lot. And that's why, you know, we're better with him back on board.
Let me take you in. The other comment you made was about list parties appearing on the scene. How do you feel about that, Kenny?
Well, I think it's a debate that has to be had. I mean, at the end of the day, I've seen some argument everything must be, you know, SNP 1 and 2, and I've argued that before. But there are constituencies in Scotland where it gets you absolutely no seat on the list. The whole system was established to defeat us, to actually make sure that there never was, you know, the opportunity. So I think it's something that's not straightforward, because there are issues. I mean, I think it's difficult, you know, to come out, you know, I think, you know, the Alliance for Independence, there are issues with some personal views of individuals. There's also an issue that they may face with the Electoral Commission. If they say they're going to almost vote with the SNP, then I think they might find the Electoral Commission will say, well, why should we allow you to be a separate party if you're just SNP Mark II? And I think that will be the attempt by the unionists. There are other parties, but I think there is a logical argument that says there are, in some areas, not everyone, in some areas in Scotland, no point in SNP voting the second day, because it's just 100,000 wasted votes. You know, how many list members are we going to get in Glasgow? How many list members are we going to get in Mid-Scotland in Fife? So it's something that the SNP has to think through and talk through. I think there are arguments against, but there are most certainly arguments for. And it's something that we should sit down, debate and discuss, but not rule out a hand or traduce.
I used to have lunch with Gordon Wilson in what was known as the Liberal Club in Paisley. There was a natural progression all the way up to 2014 that if you were in favour of independence, there was only one party you would vote for, which was the SNP. And that kind of camouflaged this list vote. I get involved very briefly with the Alliance. Pat Lee asked me to become involved in it. It then became clear that my views were going to cause trouble, so I disengaged is the best way of putting it. But it's quite clear that we've got to get our head round the list vote system. A proportionate voting system makes sense, but not if you're trying to achieve independence. It's a peculiar situation we're in at the moment. I'm hoping that there are some very wise heads within the SNP who will try and find a way of thinking their way through that. Exactly as you said, there'll be certain seats where it becomes kind of obvious, but they'll have to be clever about how they go about it, because the Electoral Commission, for all sorts of reasons, will watch very closely what's going on. That was one of the worries I had about the Alliance, is the Electoral Commission are not, they're not dummies.
If you look back at what happened in the south of Wales, at the recall election in 2019, September 2019, the Liberal Democrats asked Plaid and the Tigers and the Greens to stand up so that they could take the seat off the Tory. And the Electoral Commission didn't say a word about it.
Aye, but then that's with all these British institutions. There's one rule for them and there's one rule for us. You know, I mean, my only other criticism would be the suggestion by some within the higher echelons of the SNP that the second vote can go Green. Aye. I can understand the logic that says it's going to be SNP all the way, but this idea that some seem to say that, well, it can be SNP one, but in some places you can vote Scottish Green, given that they're looking for John Swinney's head at the present moment, it does seem to me that there's as much logical argument about voting for an independence list party as there is to say that it should be the Greens. So I think there has to be a discussion about whether it's SNP one or two, or whether, depending on the nature of the election, depending on what position is taken about Section 30, what position is about a Plan B, because the Plan B situation could all change what the nature of this election is, which could be, you know, I think, you know, very much be about, you know, independence, in which case that changes the focus on the list.
One of the posts I did about the list parties, it applies to the SNP or the Greens or anyone else. If you want my vote, how are you going to achieve independence? What's your concrete proposal for achieving it? And when are you going to tell me? Because I'll decide my vote on that. And I think that applies across the board at the moment. We've come to a crunch point as far as I'm concerned. That's why I'm pushing the covenant, Kenny, because it strikes me that that is something that people can actually do and sign up for now and evidence how they're feeling without splitting anyone. Because the one thing I know is the Yes movement have one unified purpose, and that's independence. They can argue about a hell of a lot of other things and how you get there, but that's the one thing, and that's what the covenant boils down to, vote for independence.
It's about keeping, and it's why it goes back to what we started at the very outset, Mike, because it's about keeping hope alive. Because, you know, Martin Luther King and the Million Man March, they did go to the top of the mountaintop, but what's it like for the African-American community at the moment? They're under the cosh, you know, the financial situation. And that's my worry about, you know, in Scotland, we gave hope to areas. We gave inspiration. I go back to, you know, talking about marches. I remember on polling day in Craigmillar, an area of deprivation that I represented at the time, there were pipers taking people to the polling station at something like 10 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Kezia Dugdale complained to the police that this was, you know, some sort of electoral crime, when in fact all that happened was a piper was basically leading people who had never voted in some instances or hardly ever voted, led them down to the polling station. We got over 74% of the vote in Craigmillar, and I know areas in the west of Scotland got even more because they had hope, they had belief, they thought it could change. If they don't believe that, if they don't believe that things can ever change, exactly the same as Martin Luther King persuaded people to get off their knees and ride in the front of a bus, people just turn in on themselves. And we can't afford that. These areas are struggling and we need to give them hope.
That's where we come back to the long walk to freedom. If you remember the queues for people voting in Soweto and South Africa, it's exactly the same thing, Kenny. That's why I said action over hope, because the hope will come from people doing something. And there's lots of people. We've got an immensely talented population. If we can find the ideas and if we can find the initiatives to put into action, which address the things that maybe the Parliament, funnily enough, because of reserve powers, cannot implement. One of my experiences was in competition law. It's something I've had to live with for most of my life. I've got an example of price fixing within a national institution, which if we do it properly, can actually give ordinary people the ability to raise money to put into initiatives. It's speculative, but something you'll see me do. I keep coming back to the fact that if the Parliament are stuck with reserve powers, those powers are not reserved when it comes down to ordinary people. Ordinary people within the law can achieve miracles, and that's what's got to happen in all of this.
And also, I think that's how you change people. I mean, I've been arguing that amongst colleagues. I mean, I remember when we were in, when I was, you know, Justice Secretary, you know, people might say, oh, Kenny, stop going on about independence. I don't want to discuss independence. But if you said to them all, what about air weapons? Should we have powers over air weapons in Scotland? Oh, aye, I'm for that. But then they give me independence. What about drink driving? Should we be able to do that? Aye. But then again, you know, so you just keep pushing the boat out. So there's all these things that you've got to say. But, you know, if they're not doing it down there, we want to do it here. And they'll say, oh, that's a good idea. Why are we not doing it? Well, if they don't want to do it, we should do it anyway. So I think you just got to keep pushing in all of these actions, you know, and then it brings it all together about why, you know, you then, because what's changed most significantly has been the divergence of the countries, which is why, you know, the internal market's about trying to bring it all back, because the two countries have gone in a different direction. The problems the Tories have faced, I think, now is actually, you know, we've now diverged, and psychologically it's down south. They're just at the view down there now. Well, if they want to go, then just let them go. We don't care. Because actually, most folk in the south of England, you know, a lot of folk would say, shame to see you go, Jock, but off you go. Not like the Estonians and the Latvians and Lithuanians. There ain't Soviet tanks lined up.
The Soviet Union split up. Everybody says, oh, you can't split up a 300-year-old union with it. The Soviet Union split up in 366 days from start to finish. And that was it. And that was a lot bigger than the UK.
Once it starts going, you know, they set their face to the wall. I mean, this is 2020, but let's remember, in 1920, Britain was never leaving Ireland, you know.
You mentioned Martin Keating's and his... Yeah. Section 30 position. How's that regarded in political circles, Kenny?
Well, I think it depends who you talk to in the political circles. Frankly, I think it's a bit ridiculous that Mr. Keating's is having to do this off his own bat. I think it should have been done by the government, because it's always been my belief, without giving away law officers' advice, but there's always been a perception and a belief in higher echelons that it could be done. You couldn't have necessarily a Section 30 referendum. You could have a referendum on the Constitution. It just would have to be indicative, not deliberative. You know, after all, in Strathclyde, you and I are old enough to remember votes on fluoridisation. So the idea that, you know, a Scottish Parliament or government couldn't, you know, call a referendum that would be legal, just wouldn't be deliberative, because there wouldn't be a formal agreement with the UK government, is nonsense. But I think, you know, Mr. Keating's is doing us a favour, because I think this should have been challenged by the Scottish Government. They should have gone out there and challenged it. And I think, you know, it'd be good to know.
Martin put it, I think, this afternoon, saying that the court details are going to be put out shortly. I think he's taking responsibility for the outstanding costs and the hope that the Yes movement keep on. But I think we're going to find out quite soon what the arguments are. And it'll be very interesting to find out.
That's what we were saying earlier about the Irish government's managed to, you know, change the Taoiseach, a coalition government, you know, and in fact deal with it, you know, actually working towards, you know, a further change in the relationship with the north of Ireland. Meanwhile, we're not supposed to be doing anything. I mean, it's not just Joanna. There's lots of other leading lawyers have always said, you know, another referendum without the consent of Westminster is possible.
I always worry behind the scenes that Westminster, probably the civil service at Westminster, are always on the ball. They're looking ahead. And what always reminds me is the day after the 18th of September 2014, David Cameron came out to a lectern in Downing Street and basically announced evil English votes for English laws. It took a wee while longer before that became known and described that way. But that was the day after the referendum. It was already designed. Yeah. And that's what's happening with the white paper and the UK single market, Kenny. They already know what they're going to do to decimate the powers that the Scottish Parliament already have.
I think they're late into this. I mean, I was actually at a private dinner with McPherson at one stage, and I think it must have been in 2018. And I remember him, and at that stage he had just stood down from his, you know, permanent secretaryship at the Treasury. But, I mean, his position was, oh, we've seen off Pete Nant. You know, the 2017 election, that was it. They'd won the referendum. 2015 was an aberration. And equally, we all know that, you know, the SNP went backwards because we didn't turn the SNP vote out. You know, or the nationalist vote was, what was the point in voting? You didn't know what you were voting for. So our own voters stayed at home and we lost these seats that, thankfully, most of them were won back in, you know, 2019. So I think the position that they assumed that Pete Nat had gone, which was the thinking after 2017, now they're trying to get their thinking caps on, and it's, you know, this is now, you know, hardcore unionism. You know, the Tories did well at one stage with something, and I'm going back, you know, generations, with what was called patriotic unionism, where they were very Scottish, where they could be proud of, you know, the Wars of Independence, and, you know, some of it was sanitised. Jacobite Rebellion was replayed more as a civil war rather than the much more complicated nuanced thing. But there was a pride in being Scottish. Now there's an almost a renunciation of being Scottish. You know, ironic, we were just talking about the Soviet Union. They're almost trying to recreate the North Britain that was established after 1707. You know, nobody was a Soviet Union man other than a hardcore communist. You were Russian or Georgian or Estonian. You know, you might have believed in the wider Soviet Union, but this lot are now trying to create, you know, British man. Problem is, folk in England no more want to be British than folk in Russia wanted to be Soviet. You know, and that's what they can't address. And it's our own lot, you know, the Douglas Jackson, whatever, Douglas Rosses and Alistair Jacks, rather, who are trying to create this North British man. There isn't a North British man or North British woman.
I've got one more wee thing I'd like to address. We're now in the middle of this parliamentary inquiry into what happened. And there's a lot of things going to come out that's already look like they're going to embarrass quite a few people. It's almost certain that the SNP is going to take a bit of a hit on it, even if it's only perceived. The press know what happened in the court. So I was in the court every day for Alex's trial, so I'm aware of it myself. But as things actually come out, there's going to be quite a lot of problems. That, given you've got your different sections, factions in the SNP already, they're either pro-Alec or they're anti-Alec, basically. How did the party pull together quickly after this? I think the Yes movement will be able to do it a lot easier because they've got one focus, independence. But the party itself, because it is the vehicle, independence.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there may be turbulence, but I think at the end of the day, this inquiry has to come about because we have to have probity in public office. We have to have probity in senior positions. I think it's quite clear that there's something gone far wrong, both in terms of the civil case that Alex Salmond had to take against the Scottish Government, the legal criminal case that was prosecuted against Alex Salmond in which he was acquitted. Nobody has resigned. Nobody. Yeah. This really is quite astonishing. And yet we have a permanent secretary and indeed a Lord Advocate behaving in manners. And I've worked with permanent secretaries and with Lord Advocates. And indeed, you know, both as a lawyer, seen previous ones, you know, from out with as well as within governments. I think at the end of the day, their positions have to be looked at because, you know, the offices are being tarnished. Equally, I think within the SNP, it's going to be quite clear that the behaviours of individuals in particular positions of the chief executive and the chief of staff, if they did not act with absolute probity, if information comes to light that shows that their behaviour was disreputable, dishonourable, or whatever else, then all of these individuals have to be held to account. I cannot imagine any other situation where the government would have lost a case costing in excess of $500,000 in expenses to the other side, never mind the difficulties to the government, never mind having been a defence agent for 20 years. I have never seen any case like the Alex Salmond one other than, you know, against Robert Black or, you know, the World's End murders. The resources that were thrown at this were incredible, and he was acquitted. Somebody has to pay a price, and somebody has to be held to account.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Kenny, for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to speak to you. Thank you. Bye.
In life, God.